Save big money when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior wood stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture. It repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Stop by your local Menards today.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about damning defiance and morphing mazes. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. I also wanted to take a moment to thank you for all of your donations. Every share, donation, and comment of support helps. Let's keep building this thing together. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of James Vaudrey and Bill Dorsch, our voice talents, Michelle Kane, Kevin Barberi, Olivia Steele, and Paul J. McSorley. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by James Vaudrey and performed by Michelle Kane. In it, a reclusive villager defies a long-held family rule and joins her community's Halloween tradition, only to discover that some rituals exist for a reason, and breaking them has terrifying consequences. Now, without further ado, I present to you The Wrong Door.
There's an irony about life in a small community. When most people think of it, they imagine a quiet life, much more peaceful than the clamor and bustle of the city. In one sense, that is true. There is less noise, and people generally don't rush around. But there's also less privacy. It's rare for anyone to have even a day or two where they aren't disturbed by a neighbor in need, the council leader arranging the next community cleanup, or just kids looking for someone to annoy and kill their boredom. I live in a small community. Everybody talks, and everybody knows everybody else's business. Some people refer to me as a shut-in. Others say I'm a person who keeps to themselves. They say this in a light-hearted way, as if tending to your own life needs a euphemism, like being happy in your own company is somehow wrong and should be glossed over when talked about. Only yesterday, I heard Mr. and Mrs. Martin, a pair of local shopkeepers, talking about me from behind their counter, almost literally deaf to how loud they were being. They say things like, "Such a shame," or, "It really isn't her fault." And I smile it off because they are nice to me, even though my way of living confuses them. It creates a distance, knowing how people think of me. We have pleasant chats, but only small talk, and I always cut the conversation short. I tell myself that I'm anxious to get back home to read or take Chester, my little mongrel terrier, for a walk in the woods before the light fades. The truth is, I'm always afraid of making a misstep, of saying something wrong. I may not spend much time with people, but I'm sensitive to their reactions, and I know when I've said something awkward. That's why I love Chester so much. He always seems to understand me in his own quiet way, and it never feels off between us. After tea, we sometimes sit together and watch the sun go down over the trees behind the house. So I'm an amateur shut-in, but I'm still part of the community, serving my own purpose in my own way. I live in a village called Woden Thorpe. It's little more than a collection of houses with a church, a community hall, a handful of shops, a primary and secondary school. Most of what we need, we get from the local shops. Anything else, we have to get by driving several miles down one of the country roads that leads out through the forest that surrounds us. There is no police station, no hospital, and only one pub. By all accounts, this is a sleepy village, unknown to anyone beyond a 15-mile radius. Most people here take one public role or another, either running the craft fair every few weeks or the guides troop. People are expected to take part in something, but not everything. There is only one event that absolutely everyone is expected to take part in, and that is Samhain, or as it's also known, Halloween. This is the biggest event of the year for the village. Of course, other places also celebrate Halloween, mostly by dressing up as vampires or ghosts and going around asking for treats. The difference here is that everyone gets dressed up for Samhain and not as those silly monsters. Here, the costumes are more traditional. People either dress as animals or wear cloaks and headdresses made of flowers, leaves, that kind of thing. It's said that it's a remnant of an old Celtic tradition, a way of scaring off the evil spirits. It's a big night with feasting and dancing and bonfires. Every family keeps their doors open through the whole night to welcome home friendly spirits. But the part that everyone most enjoys comes at the beginning, when they purge the evil from the woods. After emerging from their houses and showing off their costumes, some of which will have been worked on for weeks, everyone gathers in the meadow behind my cottage and waits for sunset. They huddle together in silence, no one talking. A sea of foxes, deer, twigs, and flowers, all hushed and turned toward the forest, watching the sky, waiting for the sun to touch the tops of the trees. The sun lowers slowly, the silence deepest just before it sinks into the tree line. Then, as one, the whole village rushes toward the forest, crying out, their voices joining together in a deep thrum that seems to come up from the earth itself. The wave of people splits among the trees, the single deep voice breaking down into various hoots and shouts that echo everywhere. This goes on for about half an hour, until the twilight fades into night. Then everyone returns, sweating, laughing, and joking. Then they head to the community hall for food and music. That is, everyone except me. I have watched countless times as the other villagers gathered, imagining the costume I would create how beautiful and elegant I would look. I know from the stories I've heard as they walk back that most people don't go too far into the forest for fear of getting lost. And besides, they all know that it is really only a bit of fun, a way of welcoming winter and reminding everyone that we're still together, even as the nights become longer and the cold creeps in. No one actually believes that anything is in the woods. There was a rumor that someone did get lost once, that they were gone for days. But most people admit this is just another story, told to make the night a bit scarier and more exciting. Which is why I found it so hard to understand why my mother banned me from ever joining the festivities. She would insist that I stay home. No matter what I said or how alienated I felt listening to the kids in my school talk about their costumes or how they were going to be the fastest and get to the trees first, all the while knowing that I couldn't join them. It was only one night a year, but I could sense that everyone felt there was something wrong with me for not being there, that my absence was noticed. Each year, I would watch Mother preparing her costume. She always went as a kind of forest guardian with a wicker hat that partially covered her face and a long cape of dry grass decorated with fresh helenium, a bright yellow flower she grew herself in preparation for the night. She looked like some kind of nature queen to me as she swirled through the house, locking all the windows before giving me a kiss and leaving, being sure to lock the door behind her. Ours was the only house with its door shut on those nights. The moment she left, I would run to the back window of the living room that looked out over the meadow and watch her join the others. Sick with envy, I would wait for them to run. When the time came, I would cry out with them, my own shouts drowned by their singular roar. My voice, the only one separate from theirs, lonely and weak, trapped in the walls of our cottage. Until yesterday, when I finally broke Mother's rule and joined him in the celebration. Mother has been dead for several years now. She carried on running in the Samhain for as long as she could, taking part for 3 years after her cancer diagnosis, until it finally got the better of her. She died shortly after the first Samhain she ever missed. I stayed with her that evening while the others were out, comforting her. Despite my promise to stay, she insisted I lock the door and give her the key to hold. We listened together as the voice rose and fell. That night, she made me swear that I wouldn't take part, that I would always lock the house until daylight. I promised her that I would, but even as I said it, I could feel that it was a lie. It took me a while to build the courage to join. Each year I told myself that I would do it, but as the time drew closer, I became more and more afraid, my head ringing with my mother's voice, insisting that I stay inside. Swear it to me. Promise me that you will lock the door and stay in the house until daylight comes. Swear it. Even Chester would seem confused when that time of year came around. He'd look up at me, wondering why we couldn't go on our usual evening walk when everyone was outside. I wasn't banned from the forest. I went there regularly with Chester by my side. And before that, with our first dog, Charlie. So it was the only night of the year that I was forced to stay indoors. I don't know what finally pushed me into doing it. One evening when I was walking Chester, I came to the edge of the meadow and realized it was sunset. We had set off later than usual, and as I was about to leave the forest, I saw the shadows of the trees on the grass in front of me, extending out from their bases, reaching toward the village. I stopped and watched the dark shapes creeping towards the village. It felt like watching the night grow. I stayed there until it was almost completely dark. Then I ran home as fast as I could, At that moment, I knew this would be my year. The next day, I started on my costume. I knew I was breaking my promise, but I still wanted to follow in my mother's footsteps. So I collected long grasses for a cape and picked willow branches for a headdress. I couldn't find helenium, but I found several autumn asters and decided that their blues and purples would be like my own signature on Mother's costume. Finally, after agonizing over every tiny detail and several nights of sleep ruined by anxiety, the night came. Samhain. I saw the first of the villagers start to gather in the meadows as the sun stained the sky a deep red-orange. Chester knowingly sat in his usual spot beside the armchair facing the window. I put on my costume, and when I came down from my room, he was still there, his small shadow cast behind him, his head low and sad, not turning to acknowledge me. I walked behind him to the door and gripped the handle. My heart thudded in my ears. This was it. The door clicked, and his ears pricked up immediately. With a yelp of excitement, he leapt up and ran to me. He was wagging his tail so hard I could barely tie his leash. And then we were out in the cool evening air. I filled my lungs with it and walked around the cottage, leaving the door wide open behind me. We joined the crowd. Though no one could speak until the sun touched the trees, I could sense their confusion. Some seemed excited. Others stared intently, their eyes fixed on me beneath stylized wolf heads and wooden masks. I could recognize some of the people despite their masks, like Mr. and Mrs. Martin, the old shopkeepers. I realized it was the older people who stared the most, their old minds unwilling to accept this unexpected arrival. I swear one or two tried to follow me, intent on turning me away. I walked quickly, with my head held high, gliding through the crowd as I had imagined for so many years before, until I reached the front of the line.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Most of the adults stayed at the back, allowing the faster teenagers to take the lead. But I wanted to be the first to cross the trees. I looked around at the other frontrunners, all young and as eager to start as I was. Beside me, what looked like a boy of college age stood coiled like an athlete, his stance set and ready. He wore black and white cloth, and his mask was like a badger's, with black and white stripes completely covering his face. I matched his position, planting my feet in the soft grass. I was ready. My nerves buzzed as the light thickened and the silence became absolute. Even the rustling of costumes fell quiet. All eyes turned to the forest. I breathed deeply and smiled at Chester. He was ready too. The burning orange orb came down toward the black trees, its lower edge clear and defined in the cloudless sky. It sank over the pointed tip of a hemlock tree that pierced its edge like a black spindle. My breath caught, and for an instant, nobody moved. Then the moment broke, and my legs burst into motion. We ran as one, feet pounding the ground, our voices rising gradually from the silence. A low hum building to a thundering roar. I screamed so much it tore at my throat. The badger guy was faster than me, but that didn't matter. What mattered was that I was running with him, with everyone. All these years kept from this feeling. And for what? I crossed the meadow in what seemed like seconds and broke through the tree line, my feet smashing twigs and scattering leaves. I hollered and whooped with the others, yelling into every corner of the forest. The air was cooler among the trees, fresher somehow, as if I had been breathing stale air for years, finally free from my prison. The others had fallen back, but I didn't care. I was where I should have been so many times before, and I kept running. The other voices faded until mine was the only one, reduced to weak yells between gasping breaths. I had never run so hard in my life. I doubled over, sweat dripping from my forehead, completely exhausted, but happier than I had ever been. After a few moments, I looked around. The dim light of the meadow was behind me. Seeing how quickly it was becoming dark, I turned to head back. I had done it. After so many years, I had taken part in Samhain. My steps were light and happy. My hand was yanked behind me so suddenly I almost tripped. My arm pulled backwards, and I realized that Chester's lead had become taut. He was facing into the forest, his paws dug in and refusing to move. In the failing light, I could see the fur on his back was raised. Chester? He didn't respond, only stood there, staring behind us. Chester, I know we had fun, but it's time to go. His growl was low and threatening, his gaze fixed. I had never heard him make a sound like that before. The sweat was cold against my body, and suddenly I felt small and childish, a silly fool dressed as a kid's idea of a forest princess. Okay, that's enough. I reached down to grab his collar, but as my fingers touched the leather, he barked angrily, startling me. He bolted, his lead snatched from my hand, and vanished into the dark woods. Chester, don't do that! I ran after him, stumbling over roots and snagging on brambles that scraped at my bare legs. He was ahead of me, barking frantically. I told myself that he was probably chasing something, but I knew I was tricking myself. Chester never barked. Ever. We had been in these woods countless times, and he hadn't gone after a single thing. Even when a pheasant had crossed right in front of us, he had just calmly walked by it. This was nothing like him. The light was fading fast, and I struggled to see what was around me. Everything appeared gray and featureless in the dense forest. I staggered downward, deeper into the darkness, following Chester's barks and growls. I shivered. It was getting colder. Please come back, Chess. Please, Chester. We need to go home. I heard nothing but my own breathing. Chester? My foot caught on something soft. I reached down and felt Chester's coarse fur. My hands shook as I hurried to grab the lead. He didn't move at all. Okay, let's go home. Something shifted ahead of us. Chester quivered under my hands. Hello? Who's there? Silence, then a scraping sound, like someone dragging their feet in hard shoes. It sounded strange, out of place, but I couldn't put my finger on why. I was about to yell when the badger mask appeared in the darkness. Oh, hey, it's you. God, you scared me half to death. Nice costume. Even Chester got scared. Sorry about that. He doesn't usually bark or chase people. Are you heading back? The boy stood, unmoving. He didn't speak or answer in any way, only stood there. His breathing was slow and heavy. Okay, we're going back, and so should you. It's getting dark.
Open the door.
Stepping forwards, his mask and costume became clearer. It was definitely the boy from the front row. But his mask seemed different, and there was something wet glistening around the mouth of it. "I don't know what you mean, but I'm going back." I spun to leave, but as I stepped, I realized what had felt off. The ground beneath me was hard, like stone. I had explored this forest for miles and never come across any kind of paving or slabs. I reached out beside me, and my hand pressed against a solid wall, its surface smooth and featureless. I could still see the sky above, so I guessed I was in some kind of trench. "What the hell is this?" I ran back, my hands outstretched. Within a few steps, I hit another wall. Had I taken this corner? The hairs on my neck stood on end. I had no memory of coming through here. I remembered running in a near straight line, and there had been no sharp corners at all.
"Open the door."
Closer behind me now, his voice sounded wet and guttural. I glanced back. He was closer, reaching toward me with clawed animal paw. His eyes weren't right. They didn't look like eyes behind cut-out holes. They looked like they were part of the mask itself. Red streaks ran from them along the white stripes. Streaks of blood. Fear pushed me backwards. The jaw opened. The jaw of the badger face revealing sharp teeth and more blood dripping from them. "Chester, run!" I screamed and bolted, following the direction of the wall. The thing's claws scratched behind me. I held Chester's lead tight. Using his lead like some kind of divining rod, I followed him around the blind corners. The sky above vanished briefly. I felt a sick panic at the thought of entering a tunnel with that thing following us. The click of the paws came closer, and an animalistic mewling sound. A sobbing growl. I stumbled on something, found my feet, and then pulled Chester back, struck by a sudden idea. Groping the ground, my fingers caught the cold edge of the loose stone that had tripped me. As the thing approached, I turned and screamed, "Don't come any closer!" A shape rounded the corner, a black silhouette on a gray wall, barely visible. I swung the stone hard. The mewling rose to a shocked snarl, and something heavy slumped into the wall. I swung again, and the stone cracked in my hand as I hit the thing. Then everything fell silent. I didn't wait to see if the thing would get up. I ran, and before long we were back on the meadow and close to home. The door slammed behind us, and I nearly jumped out of my skin. Drenched with sweat, I looked at my costume. It was ruined. Somewhere in the dark, I had lost my headdress, and the long cloak had torn in half. Now nothing more than a rough scarf. All the flowers were gone. I threw it off and then slumped in my armchair and cried until my eyes ached. I had no idea how to feel. Running with them, shouting my lungs out, had been a release like I had never experienced before. I felt a true sense of belonging for the first time in my life. The very thing I had dreamed of on so many nights. I still felt that. But something had come for me in the woods, and I didn't understand. Was it some kind of joke? The old villagers had clearly not wanted me there. Their eyes told me everything. I was welcome in the village, a strange but harmless woman. But this was their Samhain, and I had trespassed. I told myself I was being paranoid. Of course they wanted me there. But none of them had welcomed me. We weren't supposed to speak before the sunset, but they could have shaken my hand, hugged me, given me some sign that they were glad to see me. And before the sun had touched the trees, hadn't I felt someone try to grab my cloak? They were trying to stop me, those selfish arseholes. They had sent that boy to try and scare me off, to put me off joining in again. They must have assumed I would turn tail and run without trying to defend myself. Well, they were wrong about that. I could have seriously hurt him. Humiliated and exhausted, I slipped into sleep. I was back in the stone tunnel. Something was lying on the floor in front of me, something bleeding. The smell of copper and earth filled my nose. Cold air breezed past me from beyond the dying thing, and I knew that out of sight, something was watching me. "Who's there?" I slapped a hand in my mouth to stifle a scream. I had spoken the words, but my voice had come from outside of myself, from beyond the darkness. It echoed down the stone corridor toward me. I let out a whimper, and it happened again. The sound formed in my throat, but when it left my mouth, it came from somewhere else. I couldn't breathe. I didn't dare let out another sound. My head was filled with a whispering, a language I didn't recognize. I groped around in panic, slapping my hands against the cold stone that surrounded me. Suddenly, I was trapped. The dark corridor was gone, replaced with blank walls, closing in on me from every direction. I screamed and heard my muffled cry somewhere outside the stone. There was no way out. Then I hit something, a handle jutting from the rock. I pressed it down and the wall started to shift. It was a door, an escape. Another distant voice, not my own, but coming from the same place beyond the walls. One I hadn't heard in years. The voice of my mother. "Keep the door locked. Don't go outside." Confused, I lifted my hand away. The stone fell back into place. I looked around, but there was still nothing but darkness. "Why?" I asked, struggling against panic as I heard myself speaking from outside. Silence. I waited for an answer, reluctant to ask again, sure that it was my mother's voice I had heard. My mouth opened and I spoke.
"Open the door."
I smashed my hands hard against my mouth. A voice had spoken and it had come from my mouth, but it wasn't my voice. Tears ran down my face. I breathed in shallow, panicked gasps. On the verge of passing out, I tried to lower my hands. It happened again.
"Open the door."
A deep, guttural voice. It pushed out of my throat like wet gravel. I lost control. I battered against the walls, my hands smashed against the unyielding stone. My screams echoed outside as the hateful voice worked my mouth over and over.
"Open the door. Open the door. Open the door."
When I woke, Chester was pressing his muzzle into my cheek, whimpering softly. The curtains were still open and I could see the looming black forest against the navy sky. I jumped from the chair and yanked the curtain shut. Then I sprinted to the door and slammed the latch across. With shaking hands, I fumbled for my key, and after repeatedly scraping it against the keyhole, I finally twisted the door lock shut. The click of the heavy bolt broke my terror. Relief washed over me. The dream had been so real, so vivid. My clothes were damp with sweat and my legs were loose and weak, like I had just run a marathon. I told myself that this wasn't worth it. Maybe Mom had been right all this time. She must have known I was too sensitive for the festival. I decided that once was enough and next time I would watch from the window. Comforted by this thought, I stepped toward the stairs. The door banged so hard it rattled in its hinges. I jumped back and stared at the sturdy wooden planks and thick black locks, fully expecting someone to break in. Chester barked madly beside me. It scared me to hear him bark. He really never made any sound above a happy rumble when having his back scratched. After several minutes, nothing had happened. Convinced I was overtired, my tense state clearly spooking Chester, I turned for the stairs and the soft, warm bed that waited for me. The door banged again, three times, like someone was hammering against it. "Go away, please. I don't want to take part anymore. I'm too tired. I need to sleep." I thought I heard someone answer, but they were muffled and I couldn't make out the words. I shuffled toward the door. "I'm sorry, but I missed that. What did you say?" There was definitely someone talking. I pressed myself to the door, its wood cool against my face. I heard wind through dry leaves and someone whispering in another language, ancient and menacing. Whoever had banged was still there. I let out a shaking breath. "Please, whoever you are, I want you to go. You can come back in the morning if you need to speak to me." More whispering, nonsense words, made up words. I stepped back from the door. "Look, I've had enough of this and I'm telling you to go. And if you don't, I'll be forced to make you." No one answered, but I hadn't heard anyone leave either. I became sure that it was kids from the village playing a prank. The same kids that had been told to try and scare me out of the woods. The kids who had ruined my night. Heat rose in my chest. They were making fun of me. "Right, that's it." I marched forwards and unlocked the door. With my umbrella raised high above my head, I swung the door open. There was no one there. I stepped out, expecting to hear running feet and teenage jeers as the pranksters fled. The night was still, without even a breeze. Silvery moonlight glimmered on everything in a thin film, showing nothing but an empty street. I slammed the door shut and locked it. I rested my head against it and closed my eyes. It was definitely time for bed.
"You should open the door,"
said a growling voice behind me. I did, but there was no one there. My eyes shot open. I turned around and there was Chester in the middle of the living room, his shoulders hunched forwards and his hackles raised. "What did you say?" I asked through numb lips.
"I said you should open the door."
His mouth contorted horribly, a dog's snout trying to work like a human's, snarling and drooling over bone-white teeth. Vertigo spun the room, and my stomach heaved toward my throat. My words came out in a drunken slur. "Chester, you shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be talking."
"Open the door."
The final word dropped into a deep growl that rumbled through the room. Chester's mouth opened wide and curled backward, revealing a crimson maw packed with row upon row of triangular fangs. I lurched back and felt a crack. Warm liquid ran down the nape of my neck. With numb fingers, I felt my scalp, and when my fingers came back into view, they were covered in blood. In the room beyond them, the Chester thing's jaw grew and grew, lengthening out as long as his body. A whip-like tongue lashed around the widening throat, searching for me. With nowhere to go, I threw my umbrella at the gaping mouth and the tongue whipped to it, coiling inwards like a spring trap. I screamed and rushed forward, kicking wildly. The Chester thing gargled as I hit it side on with all my strength. I kicked it again and it whimpered wetly. spitting out the stand and bolting into the back room, dragging its jaw along the floor. I followed it and slammed the door shut, and then slumped down and cried. Then the front door shook. The door knocker was back, hammering again and again, louder and louder, bulging the frame with each hit. I ran toward it, but then that Chester thing battered against the wood behind me. I whirled in the middle of the room, each bang resounding in my head. And something else. Someone knocking against the back window. I threw the curtains back and screamed. The frame was full of animal faces pressed against every inch of the glass. I thought it was the villagers crowding around to stare at me, the town freak. But their eyes were like the Badger Man's, real animal eyes bleeding into their fur. I could smell the blood from inside. The front door started to splinter. They were coming in. I bolted upstairs and slammed my bedroom door. I can see the forest from my bed through the window. When I was a child, I would go to sleep watching the light dim over the trees. Sometimes I thought I saw someone standing in the trees. A lone figure, their face a blur of white in the twilight. The shadows of the trees grew toward my room. Fingers of night reaching out to me alone, beckoning to me. The darkness would pool over the grass, and then the figure would run towards me. I would always lose sight of it as it dropped below the window frame, and by the time I got up to look, it was gone. I told my mother about it once, and the next day she painted over the window. They won't leave me alone. They're in the house now. They whispered to me from the hallway, using different voices to try and lure me out, but I won't go. I'm not stupid. I dragged the wardrobe against the door so they can't get in either. I've tried to ask them to leave, but my voice is gone. I can't make a sound. The noise is unbearable. They're banging on everything, every door, every window. I wrapped the duvet around my head, but it did no good. It's too loud to think. I can't take it anymore. They won't leave me alone. There's no way out. No way for me to leave. Except one. I could open the other door. The one from my dream. It's here, in my head. The huge stone door stands in front of me. There's something pounding on it from the other side, too. My hand rests on the handle. I can't hear Mother anymore. There's no one to stop me. I press down and the door glides open. A figure stands in the dark doorway. They're wearing a mask of bone, a blank mask with two circular eye sockets cut out. Long fingers reach up and clutch the edges of it. It falls to the floor, revealing a familiar face. My face. In the stories, they said that the kid got lost in the forest. But now I know I wasn't lost at all. I was home.
I hope you enjoyed The Wrong Door, as written by James Vaudrey, performed by Michelle Caine, and produced by Brad Parsons. Michelle Caine's work is proudly featured on our network, as well as on the Creepy Podcast, which you can hear on any podcasting app, as well as on www.creepypod.com. Our second tale of the evening is written by Bill Dorsch, and is performed by Kevin Barberi, Olivia Steele, and Paul J. McSorley. In it, Owen and Emily eagerly attend a mysterious Halloween carnival, only to find themselves trapped in a nightmarish maze where sinister performers blur the line between reality and horror with no escape in sight. Now, without further ado, I present to you Le Carnaval des Horreurs.
The rear door of the house swung open. Rushing into the kitchen, Owen excitedly ran up to the house phone on the wall. He nearly dropped the receiver as he hurriedly pressed the numbers to call his friend Emily.
Hello?
Answered Emily after a few rings. Em, did you see the flyers? Tell me you saw them, Owen replied.
Slow down. What are you talking about? What flyers?
Emily asked. Halloween Carnival! It's coming in 2 weeks! We gotta go! Owen exclaimed as he stared at the illustrated paper. Le Carnaval des Horreurs, it read. Halloween night, dusk till dawn, admission $20, all inclusive. Rides, food, scares, all for one low price. The flyer was expectedly black, with a bright green font that had trails at the bottom of the letters to mimic slime or blood. Depictions of various rides and attractions, along with the requisite carnival tent graphic, adorned the space. Emily enjoyed Halloween as much as the next person, but Owen's love of the celebration went to another level. Friends since childhood, Emily couldn't remember a time where Owen wasn't knee-deep in all things Halloween. She was much more casual a Halloween goer, and was never too big of a carnival person. Still, she realized quickly that there was going to be no avoiding the subject.
Sounds great, Owen.
She sheepishly responded.
I'm sure you're really excited about it.
It's gonna be so amazing, Owen continued. Oh man, what am I gonna wear? So many shirts to pick from. Michael Myers? Nah, too cliche. Gremlins? No, too cute. Reanimator? No, too obscure. Emily couldn't help but chuckle to herself at Owen's resemblance to a girl trying to decide on her prom dress. It was cute, even if she didn't fully understand what difference a shirt was going to make. Still, she knew this was going to be even bigger to Owen than any prom would be. 2 weeks may as well have been 2 years for Owen. The community college that Owen attended saw very little of him as he prepared himself for the event. He watched every horror movie he could get his hands on from the local video store, read horror magazines, and listened to every horror movie soundtrack he could find. All things he was intimately familiar with and likely could quote from memory already. But Owen couldn't fathom going to this event understudied. Super Bowl quarterbacks have played the big game less prepared than Owen was for this carnival. The pivotal Saturday had finally arrived. Emily awoke to her phone ringing. Sluggishly, she stumbled over to the receiver and picked it up.
Hello?
She said, more groaning than speaking. Em, wanted to make sure you're all set for tonight. A clearly excited Owen asked.
It's 6:30 in the morning. Why are you already up?
Emily asked, half annoyed, half asleep. So we're meeting at the gate at 5, right? Owen asked, ignoring Emily's question.
Yeah, sure.
Emily replied, wanting to end this conversation as soon as possible and return to bed. She knew how long the night was going to be. Great. See you then. Bye. Owen concluded, and then hung up before Emily had a chance to say anything else. If it was anyone besides Owen and any event other than this, Emily would have been more upset. She understood that Halloween was Owen's Christmas, birthday, WrestleMania, and summer vacation all wrapped up into one. She shook her head slowly, sighed, and returned to bed. Emily arrived at the parking lot at 5:03. Owen was by the gate, pacing wildly as she walked up to the entrance. Em, whew, I thought something had happened, Owen said with an excited worry.
Owen, it's a couple minutes past 5. Don't be dramatic,
Emily replied.
Went with Nosferatu, huh?
Yeah, it's a classic. Best vampire ever. Let's go. Everything looks so amazing. This is going to be the best night ever, Owen proclaimed as Emily laughed to herself and shook her head slightly with a small grin. The two walked up to the entrance where the line to purchase entry was located. In the booth was a man in tattered clothing, stringy long hair, sunken eyes, and a slack jaw. Hello, my friend, Owen greeted the worker. Two, please. The worker said nothing, but held out a gnarled, thin hand. Owen paused, waiting for a response. Receiving none, he reached into his wallet.
"Ah, I see. Can't break character. I get it. Nice touch," he said as he pulled a pair of $20 bills out and handed them over.
The worker slowly grasped the bills and placed two green bracelets on the ledge. The worker returned to a still, unblinking stance.
"Thanks, Lurch,"
Owen said as he grabbed the bracelets. He helped Emily put hers on and fastened his own. The carnival was immense. Pathways spread in all directions, leading to rides, food, games, attractions, everything one could ever ask for from an event like this. The decor was dark, with everything given an element of gore or mayhem. Each stand contained a worker that looked as if they had risen from the grave that morning. Each ride looked as though one might exit with fewer limbs than when they entered. Even the food had a grotesque vibe. Popcorn with green and black drizzle soaked in. Burgers on black-colored buns. Funnel cakes with a viscous red topping. And fried chicken with what appeared to be a tail sticking out the bottom of the drumstick. Owen asked Emily if she wanted to get anything, but Emily said that she didn't have much of an appetite. Certainly, the presentation of the food didn't help in that regard. Owen stopped to get an order of fried worms, thin mozzarella strands twisted and fried up to be roughly in the shape of earthworms, and a bag of cotton candy that looked suspiciously like someone's hair. He gleefully ate as Emily patiently followed as he walked around the area. As they walked by the section of games, Owen turned to Emily.
"All right, time to win a prize. What do you want me to win you?" he said confidently.
"First off, there's no chance you're winning one of these games. Second, there is no chance I'm taking one of those things home,"
she replied.
"Aw, come on," Owen insisted. "What about one of those stuffed Cthulhus? They're cute. You can snuggle with him and think about how cool your pal Owen is for overcoming the odds and taking down the unwinnable carnival game."
"Okay, hotshot,"
Emily chuckled while shaking her head.
"You go get him."
Owen walked up to a game featuring a line of air rifles with the objective of knocking down various horror icons. Owen showed his bracelet to the zombified attendant and picked up his rifle. Several pulls of the trigger later, the world remained in peril as none of the villains had met their end via air pellet.
"Nice shooting, Tex,"
Emily teased.
"Ghostbusters doesn't count as a horror movie,"
Owen retorted with a scrunched-up glare.
"This gun is off. The sights must be warped, or the barrel must be twisted, or the action must be... ugh."
No, go on. You clearly know what you're talking about,"
Emily continued to rib. Owen scoffed, putting the rifle back down.
"All right, forget the games. Let's hit a ride. What do you say?"
he asked. Emily agreed, provided it wasn't something that went high into the air. Having one of these rides break down while they were 50 feet up was not on her checklist for the evening. They settled on the carousel. Of course, the ride did not feature your standard horses, instead offering mounts like the Cerberus, giant wolves, giant rats, and a giant spider. Owen gleefully jumped on the back of the Cerberus, while Emily chose one of the wolves. As the ride began its journey around the circle, Emily started to look around. She thought she had noticed something, but the ride was moving so fast she couldn't be sure. Each trip around, she tried to focus on the area, but couldn't quite get a good enough glimpse. Shortly, the ride came to an end, and they disembarked. Owen noticed Emily's preoccupation and gently nudged her.
"Yo, Em, you still with us?"
he asked playfully.
"Did you see anything strange while we were on the ride?"
she replied.
"No, I don't think so. What do you mean?"
Owen inquired.
"I thought I saw someone... someone staring at me. Sort of dressed up, you know, like one of those people you'd see at an old-time party with the jacket and the hat and stuff,"
Emily answered.
"Can't say I saw anything like that, but I also wasn't looking. Sorry. Was he doing anything?"
Owen asked.
"No, not really, but I couldn't get a good enough look. The ride was too fast. I think he was just watching,"
Emily replied.
"It was probably just some guy who got dressed up for the carnival to get into the mood. Was he a handsome, staring gentleman? Do you want me to find him and set you up?"
Owen joked with a mischievous grin and eyebrow raise.
Sure. Maybe he can shoot an air rifle.
Emily cracked back with a sarcastic look.
Ouch! Low blow!
Owen said, feigning emotional pain.
Okay, what next? Say, did you see the big tent in the middle? I bet they got something cool going on there. Want to check it out?
He asked.
Sure, why not?
Emily said as they turned toward the center of the carnival. The giant tent was as menacing as the rest of the carnival. Black and white vertical stripes adorned the outside, while a series of dim purple lights glowed up the sides, giving an extra touch of unease. People seemed to be lining up near the door. Owen hastened his pace to get a spot in line.
I don't know what is in there, but we should check this out. I bet it'll be a show of some sort, Owen speculated.
Emily caught up to Owen and stood next to him in line as the people ahead began to file in. As they entered, rows of bleacher seats ran around the outer rim of the floor in a U-shape, either side ending near a platform that jutted out to the center, meeting a stage. After the crowd had all found seats, the lights in the tent dimmed and a spotlight shone on the platform. Calliope music played, echoing through the space in a tone that could only be described as menacing. As the notes brought the mood to unease, the curtain by the platform parted to reveal a man wearing a dark purple tailcoat trimmed in black, with black pants, a purple bow tie, and a tall black top hat. He was tall, somewhat thin, and held a cane with a large round purple jewel affixed to the top. His presence was hypnotic, his movements deliberate but graceful. His eyes conveyed command, and his gaze was enough to make anyone pause.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
the man said in a strong, emotive voice.
"Le Carnaval des O'Hare is honored by your attendance tonight. Mystery, intrigue, dread all await you as you walk the path of darkness this evening. Your fortitude, your will, your very sanity will be tested as we journey into the world of the arcane. It is my obligation to suggest those with weaker constitutions or those with mental well-being could be damaged by that which you are about to experience, seek refuge elsewhere. This journey is designed solely for those who are prepared for their souls to be transmogrified, taken through doors never thought possible. Are you prepared? Will you take the first step on the journey with me tonight?"
The man outstretched his arms with the last sentence, to which applause from the audience was given in response.
"Okay, he's not too bad. Decent delivery, if a bit cliché,"
Owen murmured to Emily. He nudged her slightly and continued.
"What do you think we're about to see?"
Emily only responded with a slight head shake and a shrug.
"You okay, Em?"
Owen asked.
I think that's the guy I saw when we were on the carousel,"
Emily answered.
"What, him?" Owen replied. "I doubt he was hanging around the carousel just checking people out while he had a show to get ready for."
"I'm serious, Owen,"
Emily said.
"I didn't get a clear look, but I really think that's him."
"Do you want to leave the show?"
Owen asked in a somewhat dejected tone.
"If it's too scary, we can go do something else."
"No, it's fine,"
Emily hesitantly replied.
"It's just a show, right?"
The mysterious gentleman continued.
"For our first stop, we take you to the deepest corners of the Amazon. Within the Jungle Kingdom, there was but one ruler, one that claimed all that laid before her. Now, she walks among us here, and you have the distinct privilege of meeting her tonight. I present to you, the Queen Cobra."
On stage walked a woman covered head to toe in greenish-blue scales. She was of average height and build, but moved with a rhythm that loosely resembled that of a snake. Her eyes were a bright yellow and narrowed, giving her an evil glare that was unsettling. She licked her lips, revealing a long, forked tongue that darted back and forth before retreating into her mouth. She wore what appeared to be a swimsuit, also adorned in scales. She then looked around the room while letting out a long hiss, revealing long, thin, sharp fangs.
our queen has a rich history of dominance in her kingdom and is capable of overcoming the fierest of foes. I caution you to remain on alert while in her presence, as she can strike in the blink of an eye.
The man warned. The woman then slithered back from whence she had appeared, giving one last glare around the room before moving through the curtain. The man gave the room time to applaud, then continued.
Our next stop on this journey takes us to the peaks of Kilimanjaro. This mighty summit has hosted many a brave soul and stands as a symbol of strength and endurance. From its depths rose a man so in tune with the stones that lie within that he became that which bore him. I give you the Obsidian Giant.
The room trembled as out to the stage strode a man so large it was nearly inconceivable. Appearing nearly 9 feet tall and wider than three people standing shoulder to shoulder, the Obsidian Giant looked to be made entirely of jagged black stone. Each step shook the stage, and a resounding thud trailed each of his footsteps. The giant did not move around much, instead simply standing in front of the crowd, allowing his massive presence to be the performance.
Those at the top of their physical abilities may be able to overcome the challenges of Kilimanjaro, but do not let overconfidence be your downfall. Many have climbed its peak, but none have bested the Obsidian Giant. My recommendation to you is to turn and flee should you ever find yourself on the wrong side of his temperament.
The mysterious man said. The giant slowly turned himself around and thudded back to the curtain.
Finally,
the man continued,
we come to the final stop in our Odyssey of the Unknown. For this, we must travel to the deepest realms of China. For centuries, this woman has bested armies, kingdoms, dynasties, and all points in between. Feared by all who dare cross her path, I present the Dragon Lady.
Out from the back, an elderly-looking woman walked to the stage. She had a frail gait that was more shuffle than walk. She slowly approached the edge of the stage and stood.
Is this for real? Owen asked Emily with a small chuckle. She's like 80 pounds soaking wet, and looks like a slow breeze could break her in half. At least they made the other two look the part.
Emily didn't respond, staring straight ahead. Owen nudged her a bit, but saw she was not intending to say anything. He returned his attention to the stage. The Dragon Lady began to arch up slightly, rising up from her hunched-over original state. Taking a deep breath, she exhaled, bringing forth a massive flame from her mouth. The fire projected nearly 10 feet and drew gasps of astonishment from the crowd. She held no torch, as most fire-breathing acts would. Instead, this seemed to come directly from inside, with no apparent flint or tinder.
Whoa! Owen exclaimed. Did you see that, Em? How does she do that?
Emily continued to watch with a wide-eyed look, but didn't say anything, shaking her head slightly.
Conquerors, emperors have all fallen to the kiss of the Dragon Lady. Be forewarned, there can be no extinguishing the flames of the dragon. Let this be a lesson to never rely on appearances alone,
the man said as the woman shuffled back to the curtain.
And with that, I bid you a fond farewell as we return to the reality from which we departed. You have experienced that which only a select few have and ever will. You have seen wonders from every corner of the world, seen feats that no other can perform, and learned what true power and fear can really be. As you retreat into the night, I implore you, beware. Good evening.
The man concluded, removing his top hat and taking a bow as the crowd offered one last round of applause. The lights in the tent brightened, and the people began to leave their seats as the man replaced his top hat and stood watching everyone depart.
Owen?
Emily said quietly, grabbing Owen's arm.
He's staring at us.
Owen looked up to see that the man was indeed looking their way.
head slightly tilted down, with a closed mouth grin. He held his cane to the ground, though not relying on it for stability. His eyes followed the two as they began to exit. Owen and Emily both kept their eyes trained on the man as they passed by. They increased their pace and made their way back to the outside.
"Well, that was kind of cool, huh?" Owen asked. "The first two were pretty good costumes, and that last lady was incredible. I wish I knew how she did it."
Emily looked much less enthused.
"Owen, I don't like how that guy was staring at us. That was really creepy,"
she said with concern.
"Em, it's a horror carnival. It's supposed to be creepy. Of course he's going to try to creep us out. You know he's just an actor, right?"
Owen replied.
"I don't know. Between that and the carousel, I feel like something weird is going on,"
Emily continued.
"You don't have to be a Hollywood celebrity to be good at acting. The guy is just really good at what he does. He probably has done this hundreds of times. I'm sure he can do that stuff without even thinking about it at this point,"
Owen said confidently. Emily didn't appear convinced.
"Come on," Owen insisted. "Let's find something else that will take your mind off it."
The two continued to walk through the carnival, passing attractions like the Death Coaster, the Black Moat Cruise, and the Funnel to Hades. Emily made it clear she was not going to be trusting any of those rides, which Owen understood. Soon, they walked up to something that caught his eye.
"Hey, check it out," Owen said while pointing. "The House of Haunted Mirrors. That sounds cool. I bet it's a bunch of those funny mirrors that make you look all distorted or huge. Want to go in?"
Emily agreed, thinking that it seemed a fairly mild thing amidst the rest of the place. They walked up to the entrance, showed their bracelets to the now normalized, slack-faced worker, and entered. As soon as they reached the first room, they realized what they had walked into.
"Oh, it's a mirror maze,"
Owen declared, excitedly. Emily looked slightly annoyed, but forced a small smile, realizing she had been starting to go down the path of a downer and not wanting to be a wet blanket on Owen's night.
"All right,"
she said.
"Where should we start?"
There were four different starting paths they could choose. The lights were dim, adding to the potential disorientation.
"We should race," Owen challenged. "Last one out buys dinner tomorrow."
"All right, Hotshot. You're on."
Emily accepted, a bit of playfulness returning to her demeanor. They each chose a separate starting path, and the race was on. Owen raced through the maze as quickly as he could, often finding himself slamming face first into a mirror as he tried to find his path forward. He was determined to win this race and threw a good amount of caution to the wind as he navigated. He wasn't sure if he was making real progress or just doing a lot of twisting and turning, but he kept pressing on. As he turned a corner, he came to a sudden stop. At the end of the corridor stood a figure, shadowed by the low light. Owen paused for a moment and took a couple steps forward.
"Who's there?"
he asked. The figure slinked forward slowly. Owen stood still as the shape approached. As it neared to about 15 feet, Owen gasped. A hiss erupted from the approaching queen cobra, tilting her head slightly and glaring her fangs. Owen didn't hesitate. He turned around and ran as fast as he could in the opposite direction, trying desperately to escape his pursuer. He wasn't sure if she was running after him or simply stalking him, but he wasn't about to wait around to find out. Emily was making her way through the maze using a more analytical approach. She tried to keep turning right, only correcting her path when reaching dead ends. She had seen people use this method before and figured it was better than trying random turns. She had been working through the maze for about 10 minutes when she came to a choice between left and right. Continuing her plan, she turned right and walked for a few yards. As she did, she heard a quiet voice that sounded almost like an echo.
"Emily,"
the voice droned.
"Emily."
She froze, heart beginning to race.
"Don't be afraid, Emily. You have nothing to fear from us,"
the voice said, now at a more normal volume, but containing a sinister undertone. Emily heard footsteps from down the path and began breathing quickly. Her panic rose as from the dimly lit path walked the mysterious man from the earlier show.
"I've been watching you, Emily. your presence here is an honor. Join us. Join the family. The family is ready for you.
The man grinned as he slowly walked toward her, tapping his cane on the ground with every other step. Emily screamed and turned around to run down the left path. The man did not pursue. He simply laughed and watched her flee. Emily hit mirrors hard as she attempted to find the exit. She nearly cut herself on a mirror that she had cracked with the impact, but luckily only tore a bit of the arm of her shirt. As she gathered herself, she turned and saw the image of the man in one of the mirrors. She screamed again as the image spoke.
Join us. Join the family.
It implored. She ran again, twisting and turning in a frantic attempt to breathe fresh air again. Turn after turn, the image of the man was there to greet her.
The family is ready for you.
It mocked as she spun further into terror. Owen found himself running back toward the beginning of the maze. He saw the opening to the first room ahead. He didn't like the prospect, but figured maybe he could at least get out the entrance. As he entered the room, he turned and stopped in his tracks. In front of the entrance, and blocking any hope Owen had of going that direction, was the obsidian giant. The giant's head brushed the ceiling, and his body took up twice the width of the door. The giant grunted and outstretched his arms toward Owen, causing Owen to snap out of his paws and turn to run. He noticed one of the doors had been destroyed, leaving a huge maw in its wake. He quickly deduced that the giant must have come from that path, meaning it was likely a dead end or damaged beyond the ability to get through. He could also hear the queen cobra hissing in the path he had just exited. Thinking quickly, Owen ran through the door that Emily had not taken, hoping that she was faring better than him. He started trying to watch the floor rather than the path ahead, hoping that he could better discern openings from mirrors. He was moving at such a rapid pace that he nearly walked directly into a projectile flame that singed the hair on his arm. He jumped back with a yelp as he looked up to see the dragon lady, several feet ahead and staring at him. He backpedaled as he saw her begin to take a large breath. He turned and rolled away just as another flame roared over his head. Owen's adrenaline was at its peak as he ran as hard as he could through the rest of the path. He had seen how slowly the dragon lady moved during the show, but wasn't going to chance another run-in. Mercifully, after several more minutes of body-checking his own reflection, he found the exit. Owen burst out into the night. He looked around frantically. "Em!" he called out. "Em! Where are you, Em?" As he looked around, his adrenaline turned into dizzying bewilderment. The entire park was empty. The structures were all here, but the people were all gone. He felt his body go light, and he tried to process what he was seeing. "We couldn't have been in there that long," Owen said out loud to himself. "At least, not long enough for the whole place to have closed up." He looked around again. "Em!" he once again shouted.
"Ah, the horror connoisseur himself, Mr. Owen,"
a familiar voice said as Owen heard footsteps on the path behind him. He turned around to see the mysterious man walking in his direction.
"You are a special one, Owen. You would be a great addition to our family. Join us. Join the family."
Owen stood as firm as he could, but his voice couldn't hide his dread.
"Where's Emily? What have you done with her?"
Owen demanded.
"Nothing, Owen. I've done nothing,"
the man answered.
"Then where is she?"
Owen asked as forcefully as he could.
"Where indeed?"
the man replied with a menacing tone.
"Where could she have gone? Last I saw her, she was screaming and running through my beautiful maze. Looks like she's buying you dinner tomorrow, doesn't it?"
"What did you do to her?"
Owen screamed.
"Now, now, let's not be impolite, Owen. I've already answered that. Now, shall we return to the topic at hand?"
the man asked. Just then, Owen heard a scream. He turned to see Emily running full speed away from the mirror maze and back toward the front of the park.
"Em!"
Owen shouted as he turned and gave chase. The man did not pursue, simply standing and watching the two run. Owen got to the front of the park and again shouted for Emily, but did not see her. He could hear branches and leaves cracking in the surrounding woods, but could not determine the direction from where the sounds were coming. He contemplated taking a guess and running that way, but as he was considering this, the sounds of crunching gravel became the prevalent audio. Owen turned to see four figures approaching. Led by the mysterious man, the Queen Cobra, the Obsidian Giant, and the Dragon Lady all marched forward with Owen in their sights. Owen cried out, then made a beeline for the car. He got in, started the engine, then sped out of the lot and back toward his home. He felt sick, knowing that he didn't catch up to Emily, but he knew that she was one of the best outdoor people he knew. She could survive months in the forest if she had to, so getting back home would not be a tall order for her. The important part was that they had both escaped. Owen returned home after driving mostly on autopilot. His parents had gone out for a Halloween party and had not yet returned. He was drained, numb, and more crawled into the house than walked. He immediately collapsed on the floor and trembled, the emotions of the evening pouring out as he processed what he had just survived. He was certainly going to swear off horror movies now. When he came to a semblance of balance again, he made his way over to the phone. He tried to call Emily, needing to know she got home safe. After that, he was going to call the police and have them get to the bottom of all this. As he dialed, there was a knock at the front door. He jumped and dropped the receiver at the sound. He slowly made his way to the window, peeking out to see who was on the porch. His heart skipped a beat. "Em!" Owen cried out as he threw the door open and pulled his friend inside. He shut and locked the door, then turned back to Emily. "Oh my God, I couldn't catch up to you. I couldn't tell which way into the woods you had gone. I'm so sorry. I didn't know what to do. Are you okay? I was about to call your house."
Hey, it's okay, Owen,"
she replied, pulling him into a gentle embrace.
"I'm so glad you're okay. I was so scared," Owen replied, tightening his hug. "I'm so sorry I dragged you to that place. No more scary stuff, I promise. None. And I don't care if I was first out. I'm buying dinner tomorrow," he said with a whimpered laugh.
"Shh,"
Emily said, turning her head to speak softly into Owen's ear.
"Hey, it's okay. You can relax now. The family is always ready for you."
The rear door of the house swung open.
I hope you enjoyed Le Carnaval des Horreurs, as written by Bill Dorsch, performed by Kevin Barbieri, Olivia Steele, and Paul J. McSorley, and produced by our very own Drew Blood. On to the shows. Otis Gyre and Kevin Barbieri have their very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out The Fear from the Heartland Archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Also, don't forget, we have our very own book out. Since 2012, Chilling Tales for Dark Nights has been keeping people awake through the night with terrifying audio renditions of tales from the darkest minds modern memory has to offer. Now, in this first of three volumes, collected are 30 tales, never before available, by some of the most prolific and talented authors of the online community, each one accompanied by a suitably grim illustration by David Romero. Strange cats, body mutilations, demonic apartments, revenge from beyond the grave, and yes, even a man-eating monster or two. All of these and more beckon you further into the darkness. Turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Who needs sleep anyway?
Check it out today by visiting www.chillingbook.com. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to remind you to stop by our iTunes page and please leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, X, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.